This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. On today's show, we take time to look at mental health and homelessness and efforts to help those who could be a danger to themselves or others. Joining us today are Lieutenant Governor Josh Green, Connie Mitchell, Executive Director of the Institute for Human Services, and we'll hear from Naomi, whose daughter was out on the streets and who can share her family's experience of dealing with legal red tape. Welcome to you all.
Thank you, Catherine.
Now, you know, Lieutenant Governor, the last time I talked to you, it was following an incident in the Hilo emergency room where a man stabbed three people. That case is still working its way through the courts. But I thought of you first because as an ER physician, I mean, gosh, it could have been you.
Yeah, it could be anyone that's a healthcare provider, and it could be a loved one who's trying to get their child care. It's just really one of our biggest challenges here in society. We love everyone and we want everyone to get care, but sometimes it's difficult. And when someone has behavioral health problems or mental illness, things get out of control.
Yeah, and you know, we're still learning about that case, but I just happened to have an experience at a local hospital where I saw the strain on the staff of the hospital, everybody from the security guard out front to, you know, nurses on a ward. And your heart just breaks because, you know, folks really want to do the right thing to help people, but they're, you know, you can be hamstrung. And Connie, talk about where we're at right now with what's on the table and what's at the legislature.
So this session, we actually forwarded about five bills. Two of them are still alive right now. So Senate Bill 1124, which has gone through both houses and in committee now, would amend the assisted community treatment law with two key changes. It would reduce the criteria so that the courts could better understand and argue the law. And secondly, it amends the definition of imminently dangerous once again, because, you know, as we kind of talk about some of the folks in the ER, usually they get taken there when they pose, quote, a danger to others. A lot of times people are seriously vulnerable and a danger to themselves, but they never end up getting treatment because they're not danger to somebody else. Anyway, it includes people who are decompensating to the extent that if nothing is done, they would be a risk of significant harm for themselves as well. Because really, you know, those are the people that we're most concerned with in a lot of ways. Sure, you know, there are the people who are dangerous, but a lot of times the police will take care of those folks. But there's so many of them, and we see them all the time, who are clearly mentally ill and not able to make decisions for themselves and their health care.
And we've got a situation now where you have tried to use what's on the books to help people, but you haven't been very successful over the last, 5 years or so?
Yes. You know, we were really involved in getting the first bill passed and, you know, getting assisted community treatment actually on the books. But we found that over the last 5 years, it hasn't been used very much because I think when people were not really familiar with it in the judicial system, people were not able to get to that place very quickly. I've had experiences where I've had to go to court five times and still not get the order, or, you know, having to have somebody who is willing to do pro bono work for us as an attorney, then, you know, represent us against the public defender, who's probably more used to doing these, but really, and also has, you know, a obligation to fight this very strongly. So, you know, we really have to find ways to do it more smoothly.
And, you know, I should probably at this point mention that we did invite the ACLU to come on the show and be a part of this discussion, because there are concerns about, you know, a person's civil rights, but they declined.
It's okay that they declined. I have utmost respect for ACLU and the whole team there. But what's really happening is, both this from a doctor perspective and a government official perspective, is our people are passively losing their civil rights, because by not helping people and not being able to help people with their mental illness, they're sliding and slipping until they're in a catastrophic state. Some people you'll see, and I saw a woman this weekend on Saturday when I was out jogging. She was completely soiled in her own feces. She had her pants off. She was on a corner right downtown. And I mean, I went and got her a coffee, but, you know, she needed advanced mental health care support, because what I like to tell people, and I think we're going to hear this from dear Naomi in a moment, is that every time you see an individual out there on the street who has got very serious mental illness, they're someone's child. That there's a mom and dad out there. If this person's in their 20s or 30s, there's a young pair of 50-year-old parents that are wondering, when am I going to get help? And even if it's an older person, they may have a 70-year-old mom or dad begging us to get help. And all those years that I was the chair of the Human Services Committee and Health Committee, every single parent and couple came to plead with us to pass these bills to make them not weaker, but stronger, to get people into care so that they could have their loved one back. And I think that that is really what we have to emphasize to anybody who is not in favor of making these laws work better.
And Noma, you were kind enough to come down to be a part of this discussion today. Can you share your story with our listeners?
I noticed that my daughter had schizophrenia and she needed help. And the many times that she got in trouble and went to court and everything, they wouldn't give her the court-ordered medicine that we asked for. And for me, knowing now and seeing her being on the medicine, I wish that the court granted it maybe 5 years ago so we wouldn't have to go through it, the 7 years that we went through, what we went through.
And I'm sure you probably met many people who really tried to help your daughter.
Yes, yes, I did.
And what seemed to be the most frustrating thing for you?
To get her the help that she needed. But her being an adult and she has rights, but she couldn't use her mind to make the choices that she needed to make.
And how old is your daughter?
My daughter is 27.
And what's her status right now? Can you share that?
Right now, she's in state hospital. She had a baby, and she has changed tremendously since being on the medication. And my hopes is that somehow we can get a court ordered so when she's released, she can continue and maybe be a part of the baby's life.
So you want a treatment plan because you're afraid if she walks out of that state hospital, she's going to revert to...
She's going to revert to the old person that she used to. And it's, as parents, it's very hard wondering where your child is at night on the streets, alive or dead. I hope that baby is here to help change things too.
And you're in a situation where you're taking care of your grandchild.
Yes.
And that wasn't an easy decision either, you know, because Naomi has a life of her own and really wasn't expecting that this was going to be a part of her life at this time. But I think, you know, she just really felt like she couldn't turn her back on that baby. And I really, really am so proud of her for doing that.
And you probably have seen many cases like this where the family really wants to do the right thing for their loved one, but can't because of the whole the legal concern, I guess.
Absolutely. And I think if you, you know, Naomi could share a little bit more about what she went through, because she was sharing with me as we were coming here that she went to court 5 times and begged the judge, you know, to be able to grant an order to treat, but it wasn't the forum for that. So he couldn't, you know, at that time. And so unless she really got familiar with the laws and was able to hire an attorney, it wasn't possible. And so what we want to do is just make it a little bit easier for families, you know, who have loved ones with mental illness to be able to get treatment for them.
So you believe that if the lawmakers could support this bill, that there would be a way for your daughter going forward?
I do. I really do feel that. She has changed so much. She's a different person now that she's on the medication. And I'm scared that when she's released, if she's not court ordered, then the next 5 years will be the same thing that we lived again.
Right. And then you've got a granddaughter to think about,
yeah,
as well, and her health and safety and well-being.
Yes.
And there is a little bit of good news, although it's all heartbreaking up into the time when someone does get some help. And that's that now the medications have changed. There's way fewer side effects. They can be long acting, so that in Naomi's family's case, maybe she would be able to just take a shot once every 4 or 5 weeks. What people need to understand from the health perspective of this is a lot of times when people start falling out of treatment, they fall off a cliff because they start getting paranoid again. They start hearing voices again. And then the last thing an individual wants to do is take a pill because they are paranoid. And so things spiral out of control very quickly. Someone's back on the street. And I guarantee you, if it's a 27-year-old woman who's homeless on the street, she's going to be very vulnerable to predation from terrible people. She could be sexually assaulted. She could end up taking drugs or being offered drugs, and things get so bad so quickly, whereas this is just a beautiful young woman who should be able to raise her daughter and have a normal relationship with these grandparents. And I think what we did is somehow we got in our own way of taking care of people. And we're not asking for anything earth-shattering in legislation like this, but if someone's decompensating, any psychologist, psychiatrist, or social worker can quickly tell you they're in trouble, let's get some basic help. And my goodness, the family agrees. It's just that the person themselves, because they are mentally ill, they can't think clearly enough to ask for that help.
And Connie, what have you seen out there in your work when you have mental illness? I mean, that's one thing. But then, you know, when you've got substance abuse, I'm sure it makes it worse.
Well, co-occurring illnesses are just so much more complicated in a lot of ways. But we've found that, you know, the mental illness is one that if treated, sometimes that has been what has enabled someone to realize that they have a substance abuse problem also and have been willing to go to treatment for that as well. So I'm really hopeful with the new medications that have come out. Our team has really tried to find as many people who are willing, you know, to take the medication and really work with them to get to that place. It's not an easy thing because, I mean, if anybody came up to you and asked you, would you be willing to take a shot? It's like, you know, it's not really that, you know, something that people would say yes to very easily. But I think that, you know, the team is a very caring one. You know, they develop a relationship of trust. You know, when Naomi's daughter first came to the shelter and, you know, we were having her take medication, it was oral medication, and every day we'd have to make sure that she would take it. And you can imagine that if she left the shelter, and she did, then instantly there's no more medication. And so it's really important to be able to use the long-acting medications. And really, you know, as Dr. Green said, you know, you can either take it once a month or now it can even be once every 3 months, which is like four times a year. And, you know, you would have the medications that you need.
Wow. So that would be such a life changer, I guess, for your daughter if that was the treatment.
Yes.
And, you know, I'm just thinking as we were sitting here talking about when this first happened to your family, I'm sure you had no roadmap. And being in and out of courts and different situations, it's like, how do you navigate all this when you've never been there before?
Now I take one day at a time, but back then I didn't. I lost it. I had a hard time dealing with everything. Mm-hmm. Everybody did.
I'm sure they don't know what's going on, and then all the legalese and the, yeah. You know, that's stressful enough as it is going through the courts.
It was hard to try and have hope when the doors always was getting shut and there was no place to turn.
And Naomi, can you tell us a little bit more about, you know, some of the ways that your daughter was behaving that you felt like you needed to even get a TRO, you know, temporary restraining order on her?
She broke into the neighbor's house, and she was in their house where they were sleeping. She was starting to pick on her sister and her brother, which couldn't defend themselves. She started to vandalize the house and our cars, and she said she was going to burn the house down.
Oh, my God.
At that point, we decided to get a restraining order because things became unsafe. And now I'm in the process of trying to dissolve the restraining order so we can try and help her maybe be a part of her daughter's life.
Right. And that's the hard thing. I mean, you got to a point where you had to make a choice with your daughter, your other children, and then now this new grandchild.
Mm-hmm. It's a gamble. We don't know what's going to happen in the future, but I feel if she's medicated, it might give her a chance for her to start her life again.
Isn't she really involved even right now?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. She calls the baby every day and talks to the baby on the phone in the morning and at night. And it's just heartwarming.
Yeah, so she's bonding with her child. Mm-hmm. So you see hope there.
I think when she was on the medication, she bonded with the child when it was in her stomach. But the medicine helped her do that.
Right. So that's that bit of sanity in life and what you hope to achieve with the changes in the bill.
Absolutely. And in her particular story, the reason why she was moved from OCCC to the state hospital was because when they realized that she was pregnant and, you know, she wasn't even accepting that she was pregnant because of her mental illness. Yeah,
right.
I just thought, okay, this is not a good thing. You know, we do not know what's going to happen as she progresses in her pregnancy. But I'm so thankful that she was able to get to the state hospital and actually be placed on medications at that time.
And Lieutenant Governor, I mean, what have you seen either out on the street now that, you know, kind of homelessness is your Juliana right now,
yeah.
right?
Well, I've seen innumerable people suffering this way. I see a lot of people that have been like Naomi's daughter, but out on the street for a decade. And after 6 months, you've added a post-traumatic stress condition to whatever other underlying challenge they have, whether it's schizophrenia or bipolar or whatever. After a couple years, they've been victimized and are really having a hard time integrating with society. And if you have the mental illness and, God forbid, additional addiction, we're going to start running out of hope. So it's impossible for me to imagine that we would allow any barriers to care to exist. I just can't believe, even though, of course, I have total respect for our public defenders and the system, I can't believe that our default position isn't give people an opportunity to get health care and get well. It has to be our position, because if you really go out on the street, I mean, right now, normal citizens, we go to the other side of the street and we try to avoid someone that is seeming very volatile or swearing or yelling or maybe because they've been on the street for so long, they're not well kept. So normal society moves away from it. But, you know, it's only a matter of time till a crisis breaks out, till a big conflict breaks out, or till someone hurts or kills themselves. I mean, we can't allow these barriers to exist. And I would say there's at least 40 or 50 people in the urban corridor that could immediately get help. And then there's another probably 100 or so people across the state that would be in the same category. And there's also still many people like Naomi's child who, you know, are just on the edge of going into a lifetime of crisis. So if we can help her now, before her baby gets too old, before she's had too many terrible experiences on the street, we can break that cycle. Her daughter could be a regular, normal person again with just a little bit of help. Got great social support, great family support, which a lot of people don't have. So this is a case where, my gosh, if we can't help her child, we're blowing it.
We did have a caller on the line, a shy caller, didn't want to stay on, but has a question for you, Lieutenant Governor. How can Hawaii achieve a balanced public policy on homelessness to ensure the right of all Hawaii citizens, to achieve a balanced public policy on homelessness to ensure the right of all Hawaii citizens are considered? It should be called a public health crisis.
Yes, I think that that's right. It is a public health crisis for a couple reasons. Right now, because a few people suffer so terribly and they go in and out of the emergency department over and over again and in and out of the hospital for a couple days and back to the street, what really happens is we don't get people well and we spend hundreds of thousands of dollars of necessary resources to otherwise we should be paying for programs like Tutu Burt's and what Connie does and all these and people that are willing to provide medical support on the streets. Instead, we spend it in tiny little bursts at a very high cost and we don't get people better. That's one. The balance for safety comes from this group of people getting them some help so they can either be back in their homes or maybe they might need some steady support at the state hospital or what have you, but way safer for them and, frankly, for the public. Because, you know, if someone has got really bad mental illness and they've been beaten up or drugged on the street, the possibility they could lash out is a lot higher. And they probably are trying to protect themselves and stay alive, which means they probably have a knife or something on them. Innocent people can be hurt. I'm certain that there's extra crime because people, again, are trying to survive. And I don't even judge them. They're just trying to survive. But we let people end up be treated like animals.
Yeah.
And that is where your caller needs to know that it's safer and balanced for everyone if just a modest amount of health care is offered to people with mental illness, and then always a roof over their heads for everybody. That combo is how you get to the solution.
Okay. Well, if you're just joining the conversation, we're talking about mental illness among the homeless, and we'd like to know what you're seeing in your community. You can join the discussion by calling 941-3689 or 1-877-941-3689 from the neighbor islands. Connie, I saw you taking notes. Anything you wanted to add here?
Yeah, I just wanted to add that, you know, I once was the director of nursing at the Hawaii State Hospital, and at that time, I was seeing a lot of people come in who were court-ordered for treatment or, you know, court-ordered to the state hospital. And many of them had what, you know, you were asking about, you know, substance abuse issues as well as mental health issues. But I think the methamphetamine that has been the scourge of, you know, like our community for so long, back then I was really wondering about, you know, the impact on our community down the road. And I think we're seeing that, you know, even now, that, you know, the long-term use of methamphetamine really results in someone who even looks like they have mental illness because they've been robbed of, you know, their cognitive abilities, and it looks just like schizophrenia much of the time. And so I think it's, you know, when people say, well, is it really, you know, the substance abuse or is it the mental illness? I'm saying it doesn't matter. It both, you know, they both need treatment, and we need to really make sure that we find a way to disrupt that cycle, because if we aren't assertive enough to look at it as a public health issue, as you know your caller had mentioned, you know, we're not going to really put the effort in, and we just think, oh, it's an individual thing with that person. But in fact, you know, it's much bigger than that. And so I think the chronic homelessness that we're talking about, you know, the mental illness and the substance abuse, you know, really needs to be taken together, you know, because a lot of times when you're homeless, it's usually both.
Yeah, Naomi, in your daughter's case, was there substance abuse involved as well?
Yes, and I think I agree with Connie. Being on the street and trying to survive, and that's all there is. You either have to sell it to make money, you have to, you end up doing it, and it was part of her, it was part of her mental illness and that together.
In her life on the street.
Yes.
It's survival. It's survival.
It's survival. You know. Yeah, it's self-medication. I mean, yeah. You almost have to self-medicate if you're living in that desperate plight. I'm not saying that we support drug use. I'm just saying, my goodness, if you're suffering that much and you're that scared, you're either going to turn to alcohol or some other drug because it's just terrifying. And so that's why a lot of us, we all would like to start with making sure everyone has basic safe housing. But in addition to that, obviously there are other pieces, like maybe people might need some drug help, some drug treatment help. Maybe they might need the medication. But as our two women guests were talking about, I was thinking, yes, if you can treat the mental illness component, you peel back that part of the onion, then you have a chance, number one, that someone will stay in your life and in housing, and also then maybe they can address the drugs.
Yeah, you can reason with someone at least.
Yes,
know.
Right.
We have a call on the line. Dave from Waipahu.
Hi. Listen, my wife and I, we were homeless for quite some time, a number of years. And then finally, but she has schizophrenia. And I was in a wheelchair. It was fun. But finally, I thought, well, isn't this wonderful? We got her to be in a care home. And I was thinking, and supposedly it was supposed to be specialized for the mentally ill. And then the nightmares began. This care home was so traumatizing to her. The husband in there would pull down his pants and show his whatevers and almost raped her a few times. She was in the state hospital way back in the 70s, and she was traumatized there. She was sexually abused. She was beat up and other kind of stuff. And then, okay, long story short, what happens to her, or what has happened to her, now I took her in. When we got the house, I took her in, and she was with me for about a year. But now they kicked her out of my place because they don't, but there's too much voices, audible voices that they want. So she's back in the park. And the thing is, she's so traumatized. She will not, I begged her, sweetie, let's have, get a counselor and get you out in here and But she's so traumatized that she doesn't believe in any authority. She's scared to death of them.
Right, and you're worried about what's going to happen to her out on the street.
Yeah, and of course she uses alcohol to to drown out the and that kind of stuff. But she's been the state has done this to her. They traumatized her by when they put her into a and a lot of the public says, well, they don't, just don't want to go. They don't want to get raped. They don't want to get abused in institutions.
Right. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah. And Lieutenant Governor, what do you say about that when folks are put in a place where it's supposed to help them and maybe it does the opposite?
Well, for sure, that's a tragic story. And obviously, if someone treated that gentleman's wife in that way and raped her, they should go to prison. I mean, that I would hope is an outlier, but I know that there are histories of challenges in institutions. What I would wish for that family is that now that medications are better, that she would take some antipsychotic medication and be well enough that she could live with her husband in a private apartment like he's got. That would be the best scenario. It's certainly no good for her to live on the street. She's going to get traumatized there one way or another, and she's going to get sick. The average lifespan of a person who lives on the street in Hawaii is 51. So, no one has a long life because of every possible health problem that can arise or violence. So the best circumstance, would be that she gets well. Obviously, anybody who hears that there's a mistreatment in any facility should report it immediately to me or others. We'll never, ever, ever condone that. There's huge challenges with trust, of course, also. So one terrible moment can disrupt and destroy that family's trust. But things are better with medications now. I would try them. I would do all that we can, like Connie was talking about, this ACT idea, to get people actual care. We would encourage her husband to be involved as if he could be as the guardian. I mean, there'd be a lot of ways to put protections that he and she could control together. But the answer certainly is not staying out on the street for a long period of time.
I know I myself have actually called police because I've seen incidents in the beach parks. I saw, two men at the natatorium, fighting with broken bottles, and I had to call the police in that case. And another time down near Pokaina Street, you had two people beating up an elderly homeless man. And so, and I called the police on that one, too. But it's just, it's heartbreaking because they could become victims.
Right.
Yeah, I think that the answer really lies in a lot of improvement in the system. And it's not just one or two things. In the context of this discussion, it's making sure people can get health care, decent psychiatric care that will make them better. It might not cure the problem, but it'll make people a lot better. And the medications that can last 3 or 4 months, that's an amazing change for families. That's one. Two, there's got to be some real housing options that are a little safer. And one of the reasons we've proposed kind of outdoor living, but with tiny houses or what have you, is because some people don't want to go into an institution like the gentleman described, like a care home or whatever. I get that. I totally get that. Some people will never be ready for that. And then there's all sorts of other things. Our shelters, I really respect people who are willing to do shelter work because it's hard. And people that are in the shelters have gone through incredible problems throughout their life. And so you're talking about a population of people that are having challenges in every way. So there's a lot of things that have to be done. But if we don't get control of this, we have the highest per capita homeless rate in the country because people can survive on the street because of the climate, and Hawaii is a destination people dream of, and because a lot of our institutions shut a long time ago and people got kicked out into the street. So we're going to do all we can to support the kind of services that Connie offers and other professionals offer. But one by one, we're a small enough state that the Naomis of the world or her daughter can actually be reached out to. It's not like we're New York where we have 100,000 individuals. We've got a couple hundred in deep trouble and a couple thousand who are chronically homeless. you will see very, very positive changes in society if we take on this cluster of a couple thousand people and offer civilized, humane services, and we get out of our own way to deliver them.
We have a call on the line. Ron from Kahalu. Hi, you're on the air?
Yes.
What's on your mind?
So I'm wondering if the panel is aware of the CIT program that was brought in by Robert Colasano and the Mental Health of Maui.
What does that stand for? CIT.
For chronic mental health people, and that there's liaisons on every shift in every precinct, that there's a trained officer that their job is to mitigate the mental ill. Us incarcerating people because they're mentally ill or drug addicted, it's expensive, really expensive. We can send these people to Harvard with the amount of money that we're spending, and I wonder if the panel will address that.
Sure. IHS has been involved in the training of our police officers as well. It's a great program that was kickstarted earlier this year, so that I believe our chief, Susan Ballard, has made a commitment to train 20% of the force, so that they really understand mental illness better. We can have better responses. And so they've partnered with a lot of different people in the community to just really get a better, a better idea of what the landscape of resources are and, how we can help people differently. So, yeah, that was a really good question, to bring up another new program again that is getting legs and, really helping a lot more people.
And I've done several stories where I've seen the police officers go beyond, the call to help a homeless person. In one particular case, a young man with mental illness, but they were able to reconnect him back to his family on the mainland. Mm-hmm. And Naomi, what was your experience? Did you find sympathetic ears among the officers that might have been involved in your daughter's case?
I have some. I have. And some were a little bit more difficult because we had a restraining order. But some people have been there for me to help. I'm stuck.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you definitely saw that there was some effort to reach out. Yeah.
Yes.
I think there are a lot of officers that are very compassionate, and they direct a lot of people to IHS as well. When they realize, the person doesn't have a place to go. But I think, the legal system is just so challenging sometimes, so that when someone like Naomi, is trying to figure out what do I do, and then, the police officers feel like their hands are tied because, they keep taking them to the emergency room and they keep popping back out and they're kind of wondering, what can be done.
Well, I think that's why we've come up with some new models in partnership with Connie and all of our providers. So this is why you keep hearing us talk about this H4 concept, where there will be some beds. They've done a great job to create the hygiene center, and then healthcare will go above that, and then medical respite, including for mental illness that's not so severe that has to go to the state hospital, and then housing altogether. And having that system of care empowers the police officers, because a lot of times they don't know where to take somebody. But this would be a lower barrier to help get someone off the street and get a moment of calm where maybe we can turn the corner.
Okay. Well, this is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. You can join the discussion by calling 1-877-941-3689. Stay with us. We'll be right back after a short break.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaii Symphony Orchestra. Tribute to Broadway features songs from Sweeney Todd, Phantom of the Opera, and more 7:30 p.m. this Friday at the Blaisdell. HawaiiSymphonyOrchestra.org.
A small Arizona border town has become a magnet for ad hoc militias.
When we do ops, I'll bring my guys in because a lot of places Border Patrol won't go to.
Those groups are testing the local live and let live spirit.
We've had confrontations with them about bringing their guns in here or harassing the people that work here.
That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Starting at 4. Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Sacred Hearts Academy, now accepting applications for summer programs featuring camps on robotics and cybersecurity for girls and boys in preschool through grade 12. SacredHearts.org.
If you're just joining us, our guests in our studio are Lieutenant Governor Josh Green, Connie Mitchell, IHS Executive Director, and Naomi, whose daughter has struggled with homelessness and mental health issues. We do have a call on the line. Sarah from Honolulu, are you there?
Yeah,
hi.
I have a little bit of experience working with the mentally ill homeless population. I've worked at IHS. I've worked in the prisons. I've also worked on a task force for the state hospital to find out about outcomes, what happens to people after they're discharged. So I have a little different perspective, and I was just wondering if we could address this more as a public health issue and have like clinical guidelines for clinicians, guidelines for the police, for the court, and like an algorithm so that people cannot fall out of the system. That, you know, they've got to stay in the system until a solution has been found, because there are just too many holes and people really get lost in the shuffle. And Naomi, I hear your story over and over again, and it's been going on for a long time, and I just think this has got to stop somehow. So we really have got to do some planning and coordination. That's all I want to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Jane, for that.
I think that's a great idea. I think that by getting someone into a real standardized, accepted protocol, it would make Naomi's family feel better, and we'd have expectations, and also would take down the pressure from the courts, where some people might feel the need to take a hardline position to, quote, restore civil rights, when really it might do the exact opposite. So I think that's kind of what's going on with Dr. Koyunagi's work, although right now you're right, Sarah, there are too many pukas in the system because, for one, people are often homeless and they go to the wind very quickly. Two, if they get discharged from a hospital setting quickly, once again, it's a very, very hard thing to do to convince a person to get the care. So I think that we would like to get people to give us kind of power of attorney while they're thinking clearly that if, for example, I fall into another state where my schizophrenia is out of control, please medicate me. Please put me into the protocol that involves my family and my psychiatric team. It should make things a lot better. That's, my team is working on that with all of our allies and friends. And if you look at it through the public health lens, then it's, yes, less judgmental and it's less legal. And I think both those things would be good.
I recall doing a story about a young man who moved over here from the mainland, and who had his things in a storage facility in Honolulu, and had medication, and then he stopped taking his medication. And his poor mother was just so distraught because they hadn't heard from him, and then eventually flew over here because she was genuinely worried for her child, who had, you know, was of age, moved over here. But, you know, I always wondered what happened to this young man.
Mm-hmm. We hear that a lot too, Catherine, and it's just really tragic because all the stories end differently and sometimes not so good. I just wanted to add to what Lieutenant Governor just mentioned. Senate Bill 567 this session actually is one that would be encouraging attending physicians to intervene and begin the assisted community treatment process when someone enters the emergency room in the state hospital or, you know, the community hospital. And it funds an attorney general to actually do the petitions, because heretofore we would have to go look for an attorney to do that for us. And we always felt like, you know, it really could be something that the state took up and could take on just really this public health issue, you know, that people really need the treatment and it really could be done more efficiently that way. So, you know, if somebody, my dream is that if somebody went in on an MH1, they were evaluated and determined to need treatment, that they could then call in the AG, you know, to come and begin that process of petitioning if they didn't want to take their medication.
Okay, we have another call on the line. Donna from Maui.
Yes.
Yes, you're on the air.
And I agree with everything that's gone on before. I have an adult mentally ill son born at Castle Hospital who twice we've gotten court orders. Families like ours are fortunate enough to have the time and the means to get them. So any laws that make it easier for families to get their beloved family member the kind of care they need is welcome. One of the problems is, of course, and it's been mentioned, it's kind of a catch and release system. You get a court order, you have to find the person, you get the police takes them to the hospital, and then we're up against the conflicting definition of imminent versus immediate danger. And hospitals are quite reluctant, unless somebody has a knife in their hand, to force treatment. So I'm very encouraged by the direction this conversation is going, and I think we need to really pay attention to the fact that this is that the hospitals are legal departments of the hospitals are worried about civil rights, and are, there's a phrase, rotting with your rights on. I'm afraid that we have many individuals out on our streets, both here on Maui and in Honolulu, who are just that, rotting with their rights on.
Thank you so much for calling in and sharing your story.
I don't think you could say it better than Donna just did. I mean, she just described exactly the reason that the law has to be clarified with the words that Connie said, decompensating. Every mom out there knows what that means. Every police officer out there knows what that means. Every social worker and doctor out there knows what that means. And frankly, every patient person would know what that means if they could still be aware of their state. So that's where this has to go. And it's not that big a lift to help the couple hundred people statewide. And my gosh, you're going to see improvements in family life and community. In this case, it's a three-generation thing. That's an older lady. Sorry, Donna. God bless you, you know, who's got an adult kid. Donna here right now is 30 years away from that if we don't help her, you know. Yeah. So she has to, you know, Naomi has to be helped. Donna has to be helped, and their children have to be helped.
We have another caller, a shy caller, Jane from Honolulu wanted to make this comment. This is an illness like diabetes, no fault of the person. Get it out of the blue. The issue of access to care is not just for the homeless. There are many people living in homes and there are no services for them. Please address the fact that the state hospital requires that you have to have committed a crime.
Yes, the state hospital has been now overwhelmed by people that have been sent there by the court systems because of crimes and usually violence and or addiction. And so we're building a new hospital. We're adding a whole new hospital, and that will help a lot. And we're going to build some additional facilities on the grounds to help people that aren't certainly criminals but need mental health care. And the Department of Health is now in conversations with a couple facilities to add beds here. I asked them to add 250 beds statewide over the next couple years to help exactly this problem. And then there's the many, many people that can just get the outpatient services. So it's a continuum. It just turns out that there was a huge surge, in my opinion, because of poverty combined with mental illness has always been there. And then you add on this layer of a generation of heavy drugs that really debilitate the brain, and that made everything that much worse. And it created a lot of tough going in big numbers.
And I want to say that, you know, allowing people to not be treated actually contributes to that overcrowding, because if people are not treated, inevitably crimes are committed, even though they're smaller crimes. You know, they end up in the state hospital, and then they'll add more costs to our system. I've always maintained that, you know, if we really built out our community mental health system and funded it properly and really, you know, established those algorithms that, you know, was spoken about by an earlier caller, that we wouldn't have this problem of not having enough beds. You know, our epidemiology for mental health here, mental illness here, is no different from anywhere else. But I think we really need to think about what it would take to have a functional mental health system that would minimize people being in the hospital. You know, I think that the medications today really make it possible for us to not have that many people in the hospital. But once you commit a crime, no one's really that willing to let that person out, you know, very easily. So we really have to think about, you know, long-term, what do we want to do? You know, do we want to keep people out? Similarly to the jails, you know, do we want to keep people from going in and really giving them the help that they need before they go in?
I think we all just want to help people who need the help, right? Mm-hmm. We have another call. Thomas from Honolulu. You're on the air. Hello.
Yeah, I was calling in regards to the, you know, I take notice they don't mention about storage or littering. You know, when you guys go, when they go to the park and they see these guys like by that kid's place, they get all these rotten bikes sitting right next to the tent. That's littering. When you guys kick them out and they don't pick their rubbish, they should be cited for littering. They should treat that. These people with all this rubbish around, like how they do drug people. You know, if they're in the area and the cops stop them and they throw the thing, if there's so many feet of the area, they should be hit with a littering. Because all you people, when you pay your things, you can't throw your rubbish on the sidewalk, or you can't just go lie on the sidewalk because the cops are going to come and they're going to tell you to leave. And the other thing with that is how much of a burden is the ACLU on you guys' progress to address issues similar to something like this?
Thank you, Thomas, for that.
Well, thank you, Thomas. First and foremost, yes, the goal for people who are unsheltered on the streets is to absolutely solve that problem and erase that problem by getting everyone shelter and permanent supportive housing. That is absolutely the goal. And then to the extent that people don't accept it, when we have offered space and if we offer health care and shelters and our lift zones, all these things that you're hearing and reading about, then people do need to be cited, and that's true. So offer the services and then just be serious about it. That's number one. Number two, really, it still just comes down to getting people care. I mean, at the end of the day, if we don't get people care, and this was mentioned earlier, and they end up in the state hospital, the cost of the state hospital is $250,000 a year. The cost in the prison is $60,000 to $80,000 per year. And just getting basic medications to somebody could be very, very little, and someone like Naomi's daughter can live at home.
And by the way, that's just for one person.
That's per person. So the system has to be improved. Regarding the ACLU, look, again, I really respect the position. They don't want a slippery slope against civil rights, but we're talking about apples and oranges here. We don't want to dispel anyone's civil rights, but in this particular case, by blocking our ability to get people health care who are asking for it in their family, we are taking away their civil rights. And I'm trying to make that case not just this minute, but all year long we're making that case. And that is a central part to the solution, because we have a nice family right in front of me right at this moment who is saying, my daughter needs care. And when she's well and of sound mind, she even wants it. But it's too easy to slip out of care. So let's trust healthcare professionals and look at this as a healthcare challenge. And let's still protect people's civil rights. But let's protect it from a healthy space.
And Naomi, after listening to some of these other families across the state who are struggling with the same situation you are, I mean, I hope you have a support system where you know, if people can shore you up as you deal with all of this.
I do. I have a strong support system in my family, my husband's family, all of Jessica's family. I got everybody on board when baby came, and we just hope for the best.
Right. I mean, this is our ohana. We have to take care.
And we're too small a state to let even one or a couple families go. It just, we can see how tragic it is and how dangerous it can be. We're in very close quarters, and I just worry a lot that if a couple people drift into a dangerous space in their lives and they're schizophrenic, God knows what will happen. So this is a serious, serious problem with some pretty basic solutions that can be implemented.
We have another call from Maui. Peter, you still on the line?
Yeah, I'm.
You have a comment or a question?
Hello?
Yes, do you have a comment or a question?
Yeah, I do. I'm just kind of visiting from Europe, and in Europe you have like mental hospitals, which are beautiful buildings with huge gardens, and people are basically on level, like if it's dangerous, like individual, they are different. It's probably like prison when you have people, they have committed something bad. So, and they basically fed and take care of it, and they're not on the streets. And it's basically like hospital only for mentally ill. And what I don't understand, even like in Maui with the schools, I mean, it's like I couldn't believe the small shacks,
right.
Schools, you know, and the whole healthcare is like, first the doctor asked me what is your insurance without asking me what's going on with you, you know?
Well, we're running out of time, but Peter, thank you for calling in with that comment, you know, about sanatoriums. I know different countries do it different way. They have socialized medicine, so it's a little different system. We would like to thank our guests, Lieutenant Governor Josh Green, IHS Executive Director Connie Mitchell, and Naomi. Thank you for sharing your story with us. And we thank you, the listener, for joining in on today's show. And if your call didn't make it on the air during today's discussion, contact the Talkback line, leave your comments. That number, 808-792-8217. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. And if you want to listen back to today's show, check out the Conversation podcast at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.